Yeah, so it was kind of hard to prepare for this. I wasn't really sure, how to set up the talk, but yeah, so I'll talk about sort of trying to represent our community a little bit. So I'll talk about the physics and chemistry of the Earth, and going into the interior of the Earth, and coming back out to the atmosphere, and then end up back in the core, all the way in the center. And I will, if there's time, talk a little bit about oil. But I thought I'd start off with a little bit of history, and we'll actually start off with the age of the Earth, okay? And that will sort of set the stage. We know the Earth is 4.5 billion years old. Roughly, we'll get to why, how we got that. But the original estimates, the age of Earth back 200 years ago, were estimated from a lot of different means. The geologists looked at sedimentary layers, so just the deposition of sediments or sand in basins. And if you know the sedimentation rate, and you know the thickness, you can get some sort of age. And they already knew that the Earth was probably quite old, hundreds of millions of years old. The other approach was to look at how salty the oceans were. So the water going into the oceans carries salts from the continents, and the oceans get saltier and saltier. So this guy named Jolie just calculated how long it would take to make the oceans as salty as they were. Of course, all of these were flawed because in the oceans, the salt actually comes out with each saturation. And the other one is, well, sediments, you never really go all the way back in time to the history of the Earth. So you always underestimate the age of the Earth. But then came Lord Kelvin. I like to put this one up. And I guess his name was really Thompson, father of thermodynamics. And he was probably the first, he was a physicist, probably the first to try to put new quantitative constraints on Earth sciences. And he did the following. It's quite nice, a very simple model. He said, let's assume, so here's temperature, and this is depth, okay? So depth going down to the center of the Earth. The surface is where we're standing, right here. And he said, well, let me assume that the Earth started off homogeneously hot, so something like that. And the surface of the Earth we know is cold because we can live on it. And since then, the Earth has cooled. And he already knew about Fourier's law of conduction. So all you had to do was determine how much heat had been lost. There's some rough estimate of what the original temperature was. And so if you know how much heat has been lost, you know how old or how long the time has elapsed between here, time t equals zero, and where we are today. And so what you did was you just take Fourier's law is the delta T, delta Z, right? That's the thermal gradient, thermal conductivity, and the heat flux. And this thing he measured went down into a mine. It went very deep. You can look at the temperature as you go deeper and deeper, it gets hotter. And so this is what he could get. If he knew the thermal conductivity, he got that, so this is known. But then this thing right here is just a measure of this thermal boundary layer, which is scale, delta Z is scale roughly with 4 kappa T. This is the thermal diffusivity and your elapsed time. You plug this into here and you measure this. You know something about this, at least its order of magnitude. And it extrapolates down this way just linearly, and you get the age of the Earth. So what he got was T equals 20 million years, which obviously is so far off that it has to be wrong. So, of course, he didn't know at the time. So, he pushed this, and we all thought the age of Earth was old, but not that old. So, turns out it was, of course, wrong. And the question is, why was he wrong? This is, anyone want to bet on a guess? Or what do you read in the textbooks? Why he was wrong? Lots of reasons.
Radioactive decay.
Radioactive decay is what I usually hear. Circular quantum conduction. Yeah, so if you go in most geology textbooks, it says radioactive decay. You go to Wikipedia, it says the same thing. You go to the physics textbooks, it says radioactive decay. And indeed, there, if you have radioactive decay, you can throw in another term here, like that. Well, heat production, if you want to call it, right? And that's coming from we have radioactive elements in the Earth, potassium, 40, 238 uranium, which I'll come back to, 235 uranium, right? We have other ones too, but then and 232 thorium. There are other really active elements, but they're too small to be of significance. These guys have half-lives of 4 billion years, 1 billion years, which we'll come to. Anyway, when they decay, they generate heat. And it was about this time that Becquerel discovered radioactivity, and Rutherford, in a famous talk, said that Lord Kelvin was wrong because of radioactivity. Now, I won't go through the numbers, but if you just put this in here, you can put that in, rearrange all of this, and you'll get an updated age, and this will only be on the order of 200 million years. Still way off. So radioactivity, yes, was certainly a problem, but it wasn't the real problem. It's an urban myth that needs to be just wiped off of all textbooks. That's not why that he was really wrong, all right? So why he was wrong was actually he did not account for convection. At that time, you know, we think of convection, it's a fluid. It happens with things that behave like fluids, where you have thermal buoyancies, and they have to have gravity, of course, but thermal expansion gives you a thermal buoyancy in the gravitational field, and that allows things to rise. And so you eject the heat out driven by these thermal buoyancies. And they didn't really realize that at the time because the Earth, well, it was solid, right? The solid state, you don't normally think of the Earth as convection. But we'll talk about the convection in a second, but let's just take a very simple case of convection to see why it doesn't work. So in a very simple Bernard convection cell, that you would have something that looks like this. There's a thermal boundary layer here that's generated, some downwelling that goes here. So it's just a whole cell, and then it comes up. So this part, so I should say this is cold up here, this is hot down here. So when you're down here, you have a density difference of alpha delta T, and multiplied by the gravity, then there's buoyancy force, so it rises up, ejecting that heat rapidly. When it reaches the top, it can't go up anymore, so it loses its heat, at least the vertical heat transfer, by conduction. So this is this conductive layer. Of course, the whole thing, you should call it convection, and then it comes down. So when it cools off, by the time it cools off, it's also increasing in density, it contracts, and so it reaches a critical thickness where it's unstable, and it founders and keeps going down. So when Lord Kelvin measured this, of course, this effective boundary layer thickness, if Earth was truly cooling by just conduction, it obviously underestimates the total amount of heat that has been lost from the Earth. And on top of that, the Earth has, as John Hernan mentioned, there's a original primordial heat that the Earth started with, associated with when the Earth formed with accretion of all the particles and planetesimals that collapsed and released gravitational potential energy and turned into heat. So Earth probably started off somewhere like this, right here, and we have been cooling like that, and the thickness of this boundary layer is when the scale was with the Rayleigh number, which we'll talk about in a second. So he actually missed all of this right here. And if he could have gotten that, which is not, of course, very easy to do, but if he could have gotten that, he would have gotten closer to the age of the Earth. So this is the reason why Lord Kelvin was wrong. So the Earth convects. Okay. So what I say, well, what is the evidence that our planet convex, even though it's solid, it's just in the solid state. And we can look at this number, the Rayleigh number, which is just driven by thermal buoyancies, alpha for thermal expansion, gravity, of course. The temperature difference is important between here and here. It's going to scale with some length scale right here, between here and there. It's going to scale inversely with the thermal diffusivity, of course, and viscosity, right? So when this number is greater than some critical number, really critical, approximately 10 to the 3 from experiments, that would say that the system is undergoing convection, which is simply just saying that this is a measure of thermal diffusion time scales versus advective time scales. Okay? So let's put some numbers, well, just to give you, I guess earth scientists really work in a weird realm of length scales and time scales. We work on billion-year time scales, million-year time scales. Length scales are huge. Let me just show you the viscosity. Viscosity is 10 to the 21 Pascal seconds for the Earth. Water is about 10 to the negative 3, to give you some perspective. And pretty much this does not move on human time scales. So. But if you put all these things in here, this is such a big number, you first inclination say, well, how is it possible that the Rayleigh number can be very high? Well, the scaling here to the thickness cubed, about 3,000 kilometers, gives you all that you need. So it turns out the Earth's Rayleigh number is about 10 to the 7. 10 to the 7. So it's convecting. It's simply because these rocks, when subjected under some stress, if you wait long enough, over long enough time scales, they behave like a rheological fluid, even though they're in the solid state. Some more things I should mention for the Earth to separate it from other disciplines is the Reynolds number. So the Reynolds number is rho u l over viscosity. Same viscosity as here, density. This is average plate motions, for example, or average motions in the Earth, velocities, and some length scale. And this equals zero. Okay. What this is a measure of how steady the flow is going to be. So when the Reynolds number is low, we have laminar flow, and it's steady. There is no turbulence, basically no inertia. So flow in the Earth, overall, except in magma chambers, is going to be low Reynolds number, low inertial system. So steady flow, laminar flow, means the streamlines do not cross each other. That means you can actually reverse everything. So for us, the underside of geodynamics is quite simple. It'll get more complicated, I'll explain in a second. The other thing that's important to note is you can see there.
So what is zero then?
This whole quantity.
What makes it zero?
Most likely the viscosity is 10 to the 21. It's not exactly, it's very, very small. And you know, this is on the order of centimeters per year. You could put this on the order of tens of kilometers, 1,000 kilometers, but 10 to 20 really wins out.
Velocity also scales inversely with the viscosity, and so it's really one over viscosity squared.
Of course, all of these feed back into each other. What else? Okay, the other one is Prandtl number.
Is that true of Jupiter?
No. For the gas, no, definitely not. I should mention, this is not true for the core, the outer core. Let me just draw as a reference here. For our planet, here's the mantle. This is solid, and this is the outer core, and the inner core is metallic iron with some nickel in it, maybe some light element, and this is a liquid right here. Reynolds number is probably quite high in here, and effectively zero right here. So this is turbulent in here. This is not, there's no turbulence in here at all. Okay, so Prandtl number is a measure of momentum diffusivity over thermal diffusivity, so eta, rho, kappa, or kinematic viscosity. And this is effectively very large, since this is 10 to the 21. This guy is 10 to the 21. This guy is 10 to the negative 6 meters squared per second, Pascal second. So we're talking 10 to the 25 or so, depending on what density is.
huge. And what this is basically saying, and this is important because I will come back to it, is that as soon as this happens on the Earth, if this guy goes down, this thermobond layer founders, this guy feels it immediately. The momentum is transferred instantaneously. So he goes down, this guy goes up, or the whole part of the mantle feels that. So this is all just playing with some basic scaling, showing that in theory the Earth should convect, of course, and it has these interesting properties, the mantle at least. But what is still the evidence for mantle convection? And I still haven't gotten to how we got the age of the Earth, of course, so we'll get there. So what is the evidence? Well, the strongest evidence for mantle convection comes back in the plate tectonic era, where if you go to the oceans, so like the mid-Atlantic Ridge or the Pacific, and I'm going to do a cross-section through the lithosphere, so it looks something like this. Stop me if I'm using terminology that's not familiar, but let me just draw this. Here's the ocean, okay? And this would be like a ridge, okay? Like the mid-Atlantic Ridge, right in the center of the Atlantic Ocean. And this is the crust right here, like that. And this crust forms by melting in this region, and then it crystallizes coming out here. And we'll talk about what melting, how the Earth melts, even though it's mostly solid. So one of the interesting things is when they form and melt and then they cool, when they crystallize, there are magnetic minerals like magnetite, finally disseminating magnetite in the melts, and when they cool, they align in the orientation of the Earth's magnetic field. And the Earth has a magnetic field, it goes like this, driven by what is called a dynamo. In the outer core, you have convection, you have liquid metal, so it's conductive material, it's turbulent, it's conducting because it's losing heat to its surroundings. There may also be a chemical component to this convection, but this essentially drives a magnetic field. And so when these magmas come out and crystallize here, they will align the crystals according to the local magnetic field in that area. And what happens is every once in a while, the magnetic field lines, because it's so chaotic in there, they twist and they cut each other off, and you have a polarity reversal. So there's plus or minus, and the whole thing flips. Exactly how that happens is still a matter of considerable study, but it flips. And so what can be done is you can measure the magnetic polarity of these rocks along here, and what you'll find is that I'll color some, like this will be normal, and this will be anti what we have today, so positive, negative, positive, negative, so forth, okay? And it turns out on both sides of the ridge, we get the same thing, okay? Mirror image. And this is essentially, and the other thing is, we have sediments lying on here, so we can determine the age of all of these, the crust, all along here. And the other thing we can do the Lord Kelvin thing and measure the heat flow. You just drop in the sediments, you drop that thermistor, and this really heavy thing that shoots right down, and you measure the temperature at different depths. So you get the heat flow. And you can plot the heat flow right here versus time, or the age. So it's young here, this is 0 million years, and this is old over here. And the heat flow, or heat flux, looks like that. It scales with the square root of time, or decays with the square root of time. And if you go back, it's just the same thing as this right here. So that still doesn't prove convection. All it says is somehow the growth of this boundary layer and the heat flow coming out of it can be approximated by conduction. But what really gives it away to that it is convection is that this age, of course, is equal to this distance, x, the distance away from this new juvenile material generated at the ridge, x divided by the plate velocity. So once we know that the vertical heat loss is going through by conduction, which is like, oh, here,
conduction, but the thermal boundary layer is actually moving to the side, then that is convection. So that's still the strongest, maybe the only strong piece of evidence that the Earth convects. Any question? Okay.
So there are other ways to get at whether the Earth convects or not. There's a group of us here called seismologists, and these guys will use the basically elastic waves generated near the Earth's surface in the upper boundary layer. I should mention what makes this a little bit more complicated than just doing this from 50 years ago is that many of our properties are nonlinear and depend on intensive variables. In particular, this guy right here depends on temperature. Whoops. Okay. So if we plotted, so I should plot here. Here's temperature versus depth. You should expect to see in this very simple diagram a temperature profile that looks like that. A cold thermal boundary layer, hot thermal boundary layer. And if I plotted viscosity on the same diagram, it would look something like, like this, an increase, and then come back down again, potentially. This increase may be due to the increase in pressure, but the very cold temperatures here make it so viscous, at some point the rock doesn't behave very viscously, and it breaks elastically or by fracturing. And so the top of the, so our thermal boundaries are unique in that they can break. And so when they break, when stresses build up enough to break, they send elastic waves through the Earth, like this, for example. And you can kind of look at this as one big optical light traveling through, and the refractive index is varying through the Earth. So seismologists will have a seismometer here, and they'll measure travel time differences here, the elapsed time here. So, and once you measure elapsed time, if you know where this guy is, and you have enough measurements, you can say something about the average velocity of the material or the medium that this wave has propagated through. And if you have enough data, what you can do is when there are places that have subduction that go down, it turns out seismic velocities vary as a function of temperature, then we can actually see downwelling, what we interpret to be downwelling currents, and in some places even upwelling currents that are associated with velocity anomalies that seismologists can see. So this would ask you here, maybe this one over here would be a different velocity, and so forth. So this is indirect because it's not actually showing anything is moving, right? But it helps with this. Okay. So that's convection. And I guess what I want is, let me add a couple other things. At first it looks simple. A lot of the difficulties that we have to deal with is viscosity. We have all these parameters, like thermal expansion coefficient depends on temperature and pressure. Conductivity does the same. Density, of course, plays a role. So there's another group of us here that work on characterizing these properties at extreme conditions. Extreme because we need to go down to into the lower mantle, 3,000 kilometers down. And these are still being, of course, worked out. Active areas of research. But when you put all of these things in, it makes the problem much more rich in complexities and nonlinearities that are not so easily predictable from your intuition all the time. And that's what a lot of us are collectively trying to work on. One of the biggest implications of mantle convection is in the chemistry of the Earth and how the Earth's chemistry evolves with time. Before that, sorry. I didn't talk about the age of the Earth.
how they got that. So to really get the age of the Earth, how it was done is to take these radioactive elements like 238 uranium, decays to 207 lead, and with a series of alpha particles and beta decays, 235 uranium goes to 207 and 206 lead. Half-life of this guy is about 4 billion years, so you half, and this guy is about a billion years or so. And what we can do is look at how these guys vary with time. And so today, I guess the 235-238 uranium ratio is 1/137.88. This is the one we want for nuclear bombs. So we enrich it, and it's been depleted. And it's been depleted naturally because the decay constant of this is so much faster. So we don't have much 235 uranium left. We would have been happy 3 billion years ago. So is time if you wanted to bother. So we can just take this 230. Let's just call this uranium. I'm going to do two isotopes. This would be uranium 238, and of course it's going to decay with time. 235 starts off at the beginning of the Earth, and it decays much faster, doing something like this. Not much 235 left today. And we could do the same and look at lead and this time. So of course it starts off with some initial amount from the solar nebula from previous supernovas and star building events. But 206 lead would grow, 207 should do this. It plateaus off, reaching no more growth because its parent is largely dead. Okay, but 206, this is 207, 206 will continue to grow. Okay? So without getting into any details with equations, what has been done is to make a plot like this of 206 lead, and we all divide it by 204 lead. It's not so important what this is, but 207 lead, 204 lead. And that basic idea here is if the solar nebula started off here with this isotopic composition, then as it segregated to different components, different planets, then, and the different planets may have different uranium total to lead ratios, then they're going to evolve along this plot. So what's going to happen is 207 grows very fast, 206 grows slower, and it's a curve like this. Okay, and how much it goes just depends on the uranium to lead ratio. If you have no uranium, a planet with no uranium but tons of lead, it'll stay put. Okay, so you can imagine a whole spectrum of planetesimals, asteroids, planet bodies that have different types of uranium lead ratios. So you'll get this, okay? A whole series of growth curves, and they will all lie, if they all started the clock ticking at the same time, then they will all lie on the same spot. And so this, in the 1950s, a man named Clare Patterson measured meteorites, undifferentiated meteorites. These are things that they're probably formed and cooled very quickly, so they're as close as you can get to the age of the solar system, or the timing of the explosion. They all gave these points. And the question is, where does the Earth lie on that? And so what we'd have to do is get an average estimate of the lead isotope of the whole Earth, which is not easy because we can't mix all of the things like the core, the atmosphere, and the mantle back together. So what he did was to look at some sediments, and with those air bars at the time, it was somewhere along this line. This slope right here gives an age of 4.55 billion years. So the Earth, at least with an error, is similar in age to the other meteorites. Now, of course, in detail, what much of our community is doing is working out
whether is it 10 million years older, I mean younger than the meteorites, 20 million years, 30 million years, 40 million years, that's the numbers we're playing with now. But I think we can largely say it's within here, this is roughly the age of the Earth. Okay? So let's go to the implications of conduction on the Earth. And that will take me to a simple phase diagram. If we were to look at temperature versus depth again, and a typical rock, it's a phase diagram you could write between solid and liquid. So these are states of matter. So a melt and a solid looks like this, where this is the Clapeyron slope, and that is equal to the volume change of the reaction and the entropy change of the reaction from solid to liquid. We know generally that this results in liquids are lower density, so this is positive. Liquids have a higher entropy, so this is positive, this is positive, so this is also positive. It's just going to flip the axes on you. It's different than a low pressure the water ice system, of course, because there is a negative slope, but for most materials it's this. So this is very interesting, because once you have this, then if you have a case like this, an upwelling component here, we already talked about the relium, but the reason why it's convecting is that the advected time scales from thermally buoyancy-driven forces is much shorter than the time scales of thermal diffusion, which means you're not going to, as you're coming up, lose a lot of heat to your surroundings. So if you can approximate adiabatic, or Q equals zero, so the temperature doesn't change much, okay? It changes a little because you do work on your environment, just like a hot air balloon rises to the surface and expands and cools a little bit, so it does cool, but not by that much. And so we usually think of melting as just something you heat up, but on Earth, when it's conducting, in this boundary layer region, you cross this solidus, and for some reason our planet is just straddling this solidus. The thermal state of the planet has been straddling this for quite a long time, but other planets isn't straddling them, and they're dead planets. So we go up, we cross, and we generate melts. Okay? There's much more we can say about this, but that in a nutshell describes how melts are generated from a solid mantle. When you add on the fact, again, that the melts, the liquids, are lower density than the solids in a planet with a gravitational field, so a big enough planet, then these melts will rise up according to this density difference, g, some measure of the length scale of the flow path, divided by the viscosity of the liquid. In this case, for liquids, viscosities are now on the order of 10 Pascal seconds, maybe 10 to the 3, depending on its composition, like how polymerized these melts, actually, these liquids are. But it goes up pretty fast. And so at the surface, then we get volcanoes already on the surface. And what's very interesting, of course, is when you melt, you don't actually generate the same composition. It'd be like a chocolate chip cookie. I don't know if that's anyway. Chocolate chip cookie, if you melt it, the chocolates, it's not the perfect analogy, but you melt it and the chocolates melt, but not the dough. You hear that more, it burns a bit. But anyway, the chocolate melts, and you can imagine if you could just extract that chocolate, then I will have a chocolate-rich crust, and the rest of the mantle is chocolate poor. But you can throw in other elements. Since chocolate could be volatiles, like CO2, it could be the heat-producing elements, like uranium, thorium, potassium, they get focused up to the surface of the Earth. And so all this, all the ore deposits that we worry about are fundamentally related to melting. So zinc, copper, lead, all the ores you want are associated with this, just concentrating these elements to the top. And so if we were to do a cross-section of Earth, it looks something like this. The Pacific Ocean, the Atlantic hasn't started. We generate this thing called a subduction zone. This is where the thermal boundary layer is getting thick enough to actually founder. And when it founders, it now pulls this material down. You have some passive upwelling here. That gives you this. You get melting up here at the ridges. You get your tape recorder, the magnetic stripes there. And this part right here, you also have potentially some upwelling. It's a little more complicated than that, though, but we can also, when the water is up here and the water interacts with the crust, generating hydrated minerals like clays, fairly low temperature minerals, clays and micas, and as you subduct it down, they get hotter and hotter. It's like putting, ice cream, fried ice cream. Yeah, if you put it in really fast and pull it out, all is fine. You can eat your ice cream nice and crispy. If you put it in slow, ice cream melts. And so this is going in slow, and eventually these hydrous minerals reach the limit of thermal stability. They release their water back up. And when you add this impurity to a system, these impurities always increase the entropy of whatever phase can pull in that can dissolve these elements. And liquids are very good at dissolving all these impurities. So the entropy entropy increases from mixing, Gibbs free energy drops, and so you get a freezing point depression here. And so here a lot of neat things are happening, both from the physics and also the chemistry, and you get arcs. So the Sierra Nevadas are the remnants of a big arc system like that from the Cretaceous. So that gives that. And I guess I was going to end, and it just depends on the time and interest, on the effects of this on the atmosphere and then ultimately on oil. Thank you guys ask. Is that okay? Then I will keep going. It's just less and less part. So the nice thing about volcanoes is the Earth actually inside has carbon. Not a lot. Also has oxygen, has a lot of oxygen, 50% oxygen, but the oxygen is all bound up in silicate. It's all bound up in all the other cations. Okay? Magnesium, silica, all of those, most of the Earth is, or the mantle is mostly magnesium, iron, calcium, silica, aluminum. It's all bound in. So there's really no free oxygen in the mantle. And the volcanoes do not give oxygen to the atmosphere. So the reason why we have oxygen atmosphere is a very interesting question. We don't give oxygen to the atmosphere. But what we give is CO2. We pump CO2 into the atmosphere through volcanoes, through here as well. Okay. That's how the atmosphere is replenished. No oxygen, though. So the neat thing about CO2, or the bad thing, depending on the perspective, is that it's a greenhouse gas. So we use the Earth, use the atmosphere right here. And if you have CO2 in here, our diatomic molecules are not good greenhouse gases. They don't absorb infrared, but CO2, H2O, they're all good. Actually, methane is also good. We don't have much methane. The sun emits, so you're pumping CO2 in. The sun radiates photons to the Earth. This, as a perspective, this is 300 watts per meter squared. The amount of heat coming from the Earth through the solid part of Earth is on the order of 50 milliwatts per meter squared. So it's almost negligible. So we got a lot of energy coming from the sun. Most of it reflects back out from the albedo effect. Others, when they hit here, re-radiate out as the IR. And when you have CO2, it gets absorbed. The temperature of the atmosphere increases, and then the atmosphere then radiates heat out through black body radiation. So if we plotted PCO2, partial pressure of CO2 in the atmosphere versus temperature in the atmosphere, all other things being equal, well, you will get a curve like that. That's why, of course, everyone's worried about CO2 and global warming. Now, the volcanoes keep pumping CO2. There's nothing really stopping them, so the CO2 just keep on building, and so we should get hotter and hotter and hotter and hotter. So it turns out the Earth has this sort of negative feedback, or like a thermostat, that controls the CO2 in the atmosphere, and CO2 can react. Well, there's some steps missing here, but if you react with water, so we still have liquid water on the Earth, that's also very interesting. Earth's atmosphere is roughly near the triple point. This will give you carbonic acid. Okay. And that will actually dissolve rocks a little bit. And so I'm going to make an amazing simple reaction. You can take a type of mineral on the Earth, just some type of metal silicate, and when this reacts and dissolves that, you get this guy, calcium carbonate, and you get dissolves SiO2 in the water. This all requires water. You have to combine these equations here. So what's going on here is the CO2, when it's raining, okay, coming down, precipitation of water, as slightly acidic rain, and you weather the rocks, and you leach these cations out, calcium goes out to the oceans, and then you deposit in this material called lime, or called calcium carbonate. And that's a permanent sequestration of CO2, unless we bring it back down and remelt it or react it down here, and it comes out, but it's permanent. And this would be, if we could do this, this of course would solve most of our problems with global warming. Of course, the time scales for this, if you wanted to let Mother Earth deal with this, is on the order of 100,000 years. So we don't have time to wait for something like that. Okay? But this is sort of how we keep the atmosphere or the climate in balance. But there's another interesting feedback, and that is CO2 with photosynthesis. So, and here you take CO2, oxidized carbon, plus 4 right here, plus water, plus photons, and this gives you organic matter, what we're made out of, and in the process it releases oxygen. Okay, this is photosynthesis, sun's energy, endothermic reaction, and you take this, reduce the carbon right here. And today, right now, this is largely in balance. During the daytime, plants go this way. In the nighttime, they go that way. And when you eat the plants, or you eat the people who eat plants, you go this way. Okay? So, if you can screw with this equation, that is, find a way to isolate the products, right? Take this guy out and bury it, where oil is actually very old, and buried here, then what ends up happening is oxygen rises in the atmosphere. And the reason why is, it turns out if we looked at oxygen in the atmosphere with time, 4 billion years ago, today, humans here, about 2 billion years ago, or 2.3, oxygen is low, and it rises up to, there's some bumps along the way, but it rises to where we are today, about 20% the amount of partial pressure in the atmosphere. And this has everything to do with...
Where does that curve come from?
This curve? This actually is a hard curve to get, but the qualitative aspects are known. It's based on the fact that prior to 2.3 billion years, there's certain minerals that are only stable in a very reducing atmosphere. So we have those, and you can say, okay, it's not here. And then there are other minerals here that are indicators of partial pressure of O2. And there's a lot more actually based on, actually one of the most exciting things in earth science recently is sulfur isotopes, mass independent fractionation, which probably can't get into, but it shows amazing jump right here. And it goes, but the rest of it it could be slightly qualitative.
These ice cores?
Well, ice cores don't go back this far. The ice cores, of course, are 100,000 years or less. Actually, in the ice cores, you can actually see it's a very small variation. It's not anything important for us or this evolution of the Earth. But when CO2 goes up, O2 goes down with a measure of O2 N2 ratio. Very, very tiny changes. But you can imagine trying to do this on large scales over long geologic time when a lot of things are varying, like the flux of magmas, which is ultimately related to how the thermal state of the Earth is evolving. Okay, so something like that. But in the end, I end with this. There's an unusual time in Earth's history, and it's something that I'm thinking of, which may be all wrong, but it's the, I'm going to say it anyway. In the Cretaceous, most of the oil that the world is fighting for is Cretaceous, Jurassic Cretaceous. Well, this is dinosaur time. Dinosaur time, Cretaceous and Jurassic, so 150 million years ago to 65 or so million years. Okay. Of course, there's oil off the coast here. That's Miocene age, but it's not a lot of oil. There's big oil in the earth that we're mining is in the Middle East, on the backside, in North America, in the western part, in the Rockies, that area, all the way down to the Gulf of Mexico. They're all of this age. And why is that the case? And I'm going to make the case that it's related to the interior of the earth and so forth. And that this is ultimately going to be oil right here. But for some reason, this guy moving more in this direction, which means you have to bury this, which also means that usually this guy will oxidize very quickly. We looked at the oceans, looked at oxygen in the ocean with depth. This is seawater, okay? This is a boat, just to give you where we are. Okay, that doesn't look like a boat, but the water oxygen question looks like this, okay? Comes down. The reason why it looks like this today is the surface of the ocean is in equilibrium with the atmosphere, which has a lot of oxygen. But you have in here this what's called a photosome. You have all these neat organisms growing in here that are doing photosynthesis. So but when they die, they go down, they sink. And then they consume the water in the column. And so you get this oxygen minimum zone. And then this part is just replaced by downwelling currents. And so this is the thing. In the Gulf of Mexico right now, with the expansion, with all of this oil spill that's going on, you're pumping this out. It's going to react to any oxygen in the water, and it's going to generate this depleted oxygen horizon. And if you can do that, then you can preserve all this organic matter. Maybe we can have oil again, but we'll have oil. So the Cretaceous was a very unusual time. First of all, it was warm. The poles were 25 degrees Celsius. The equators were, of course, hotter. No ice. That's one thing. It was hot. And this means essentially that, and also the solubility of oxygen in seawater is low when it's hotter, so it moves this over here. So the question is, why was it so hot? And we talked about greenhouse gases. One of the easiest ways to make it hotter is just to pump more CO2, where there's more CO2 in the atmosphere, so high CO2. Okay. Well, how do you get high CO2? Well, one of the ways is to have a more enhanced volcanism, and it turns out during this time period, we had the largest flare-up of volcanism in recent times. You may not know it, but we had arc volcanism of these types extending from southern Mexico all the way to California, all the way into British Columbia, and on to the southern parts of Alaska. That's big. And on the entire southern part of Eurasia, we also had arc volcanism. And we also had something else. A lot of these large igneous provinces, like in India, the Deccan Traps, Antam Java, the big plumes coming up, and I would say that they're all related. Anyway, so volcanism will generate that, and all the CO2, and that sets the stage for the oceans. The high temperatures will also mean there's not much ocean circulation, so you don't replenish. Cut this off, the replenishment. This is lower. And then finally, on top of that, with all the volcanic material being sent into the atmosphere, the ash is actually a nutrient for the phytoplanktonic growth. So you would get eutrophication of the oceans and all this dead organic matter coming down. So you would generate a very large oxygen depletion zone. And that gives you the perfect conditions for preserving all this organic carbon. Okay. So it turns out, wherever you look at these oils, you see a lot of ash layers in the Cretaceous. So I think there's a connection. But what's not easy to explain is why arc volcanism was higher at those times. So I have no idea, but that must be the case. We know it from the observations. But physically, why is that the case? And I would further say this, that remember I said that the Earth has an infinite Prandtl number. If you have enhanced arc magnetism because you have enhanced subduction here, then somewhere you must have enhanced upwelling. And it turns out we have all these big giant plumes coming up to the surface and flooding the ocean basins with basalts at about the same time. And I guess I'll take it finally to the core. We talked about polarity reversals here happening when this thing goes unstable. The reason why it's convecting is obviously because it's trying to lose its heat. And the way it loses heat is this guy is colder. But imagine you have a downwelling that sticks here and just lands right there, another downwelling here, and they stay there for a while during the Cretaceous. It would potentially stay, and then you have upwellings, would potentially stabilize the convective regime in the outer core, and it would prevent you from having magnetic polarity reversals. And it turns out, during that time, there's a very quiet period in Earth's history in magnetic reversals. Okay, I'm done. Sorry, that was kind of rambling.
So volcanoes leave, I thought the cooling is what I mean, but that's on a short time scale. Right, because the sulfides.
In that context, yeah, the aerosols that are emitted from volcanoes, like sulfates, increase the albedo in the short term and cool the plant. So when Pinatubo erupted, yeah, the plant actually cooled from the ash in the stratosphere, which and these particles have in the stratosphere have a residence time about 2 years, so you could conceivably do that. You could conceivably, I guess, engineer a way to, if we just can't get together to pull this to reduce our carbon emissions, maybe we have to pump aerosols into the atmosphere. That was actually suggested by Poitsen, but I think that would be very, very dangerous.
I think I'm trying to understand the argument that the hydrocarbons are being produced by activity near the surface of the ocean and this stuff is falling to the bottom.
Yeah.
The problem with that, I guess, is that it's a dynamical issue, is that these hydrocarbons are usually buoyant in water.
So
how do they get
down there? They're not hydrocarbons yet. They're like little critters.
That's going down with the
Yeah, they're fecal pellets. They're like crap, really, literally.
Right.
Sinking down, and those usually sink. and so there's no dynamic problem. Well, there are some dynamic problems, of course. But
so why do they respond favorably to a low oxygen?
Why do who? What responds?
Or what? I guess I don't understand exactly.
They don't have supports.
Yeah, they just preserve. So.
Oh, it's just a matter.
Yeah. So what you like is if you want to generate oil or organic rich reservoir, you want it to survive its path all the way down without going back and oxidizing. And up here, the animals are having a party up there when the volcanoes go off. With all the nutrients. It's not that different from the Gulf of Mexico again. It's like a poster child for a lot of problems. But before even the oil spill, the Mississippi comes out and all this effluent from sewage treatment plants that generates this high biological productivity at the surface of the water. And when they rain out, you die. Yeah. It's like my fish pond, actually.
So does it have to be arc volcanism?
It doesn't have to be, but
it's hard to modulate that. I guess, well, I mean, at the top of Seaway, and you're talking about things like that. There's a lot of arcs in the world.
You're getting very technical.
Oh, sorry.
What is arc volcanism?
Well, this is an arc. It doesn't look like an arc because it's not in 3D. If I look down there,
the Aleutians.
Japan, Aleutians looks like an arc. Yeah.
But is the argument that we should look for oil now where there was volcanism in the Cretaceous?
Well, I should really take a step back, and especially since I'm on camera, is that last part is just something in my head that it's not necessarily all agreed upon. I was just trying to show how, you know, all different aspects of Earth might actually link together. But yes, if I were to go...
CO2 would diffuse, would it not? So why wouldn't you expect to find organic deposits all over the planet at the same spot? Why near the volcanoes?
You want reduced carbon, so not CO2. So one, you need the photosynthesis. Two, you need to preserve it. So you have to find a lesser... Santa Barbara Basin was good because it was sort of a isolated basin, so like the Caspian, like the Black Sea, those are good. Circulation is not high. But I would go, I'm on camera, so I know where I would go. I don't want to say it's stupid, you know, you said.
But the magnetic field reversals, how many of them could they find actually?
Oh, how many?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. Does anyone know how many? There's a lot. Magnetic reversal. Yeah, except for the Cretaceous, which is a long period of tens of million years with no reversals.
I don't quite catch the conditions for when it happens. You said something about the magnetic lines crossing each other or so.
Oh.
Is it something that is... that can be determined, or is it chaotic? So
that's your reaching. I mean, I don't know really much about
it. There are laboratories.
Yeah, you have to talk to the physicists to understand that. I don't know.
Yeah. There are analogs that are certainly chaotic. You can think of two spinning discs coupling them. And there are analog systems that behave chaotically, but how it really works with the full theory of that is not so clear.
We had a whole program on time.
Yeah, so look at...
Other questions?